What you fired up?
Today is March 9th, 2017, and we are here at the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee General Government. We're going to open up public testimony on SB 5534.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I apologize for interrupting. Senator Johnson and I have been in committee nonstop for the last 2.5 hours. If there's any chance you could do the work session first, then I might want to excuse myself for just a moment or on some personal business.
Okay.
I realize you need a full quorum present for the work session.
Well, and you don't need to be...
We good?
Yeah. The work session may take a little bit, so do you want to just...
All right, somebody slipped in behind me. Never mind. I apologize for interrupting.
Okay, no worries. I mean, if you have to leave early, that's fine.
I just didn't see a full quorum when I came in.
Yeah. Okay, so... All right, to resume, we're going to open up a public hearing on SB 5534, Public Employee Retirement System. Mr. Rodman? And the floor is yours, sir. Anything else that you'd like to share with us at this time?
No, sir.
Okay. Okay, are we live? Okay.
Well, Co-Chair, would you like to begin with the public testimony, or what would you like?
Well, I thought that Mr. Rodman might have had something else. You did finish yesterday, right?
I did, sir. Thank
you. Okay, I apologize. And I thought that we still had some more business that you wanted to. Okay, well, you please be excused. And
okay.
Then we'll move right into public testimony. At this time, we have one person that's slated for public testimony. Steve? Please join us at the table, sir. If you don't mind, for the record, please state your name, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Chair Manning and members of the subcommittee, my name is Steve Demarest. I am the president of SEIU Local 503. I'm also a 36-year employee of the state of Oregon. I'm the spouse of a retired state employee. So I'm very familiar with the impact of PERS on public employees, their families, and their communities. I'm here today to testify as president of SAU 503 and to testify in support of the PERS agency budget. SAU represents many thousands of workers in the state of Oregon, and approximately half of those are PERS recipients. Oregon's public employees do the work that keep our state running and serves our most vulnerable residents. For the most part, these are good jobs that support thousands of families in Oregon. According to a study conducted by the Oregon Department of Administrative Services in 2016, total compensation for state of Oregon employees, including salary, health insurance, and retirement benefits, is 98% of total compensation for comparable employees in the Northwest private sector. Now, an outsized portion of that 98% is based on health insurance and, pertinent to today, retirement benefits. The median full-time salary for state and university employees in Oregon is $43,164 per year, or $3,597 a month. One out of every five classified university employees make less than the food stamp eligibility level for a family of four. Currently, 60% of active state and university employees are members of the Oregon Public Service Retirement, or OPSERP, which has considerably lower benefits than Tier 1 and Tier 2 PERS. This percentage of OPSERP employees is going to increase every year as Tier 1 and Tier 2 employees retire and are replaced by OPSERP employees. And lastly, the average retirement benefit for a PERS retiree retiring in 2015 with 30 years of service was $3,771 per month, or $45,250 per year. I mention these things to highlight the importance of offering a high-quality and well-run retirement program. It's vital to recruiting and retaining It is vital to recruit and retain the highest quality staff possible. We have one of the best funded systems in the country, due in large part to the great work that's done by the folks who work at PERS. That great work must continue, so I ask the committee to approve the agency budget so that the agency can continue to operate efficiently. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today, and I'll take any questions if there are any.
Any questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else that have not signed up that wish to provide public testimony at this time? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. And John, what do we have here?
How about, do you want to close the public hearing?
Oh, I thought I'd close that out. Okay. I stand corrected. I want to close out the public hearing on SB 5534. And now LFO.
And then would you like to open a work session on the preliminary earnings crediting report for PERS?
Well, we do that then.
Thank you.
Okay. So now I want to open up a work session on PERS 2016 preliminary earnings crediting report. And LFO, background.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. Out on OLIS is information on this afternoon's work session. This is the materials out on the OLIS include the agency's report, LFO's analysis, and this time around there'll be, and for the rest of the session, there's no written analyses for the DAS Chief Financial Office, and they'll not make a recommendation either. This is the normal statutorily required PERS crediting report that's submitted to the legislature each year for the prior calendar year's earnings. Under statute, PERS board must provide the report at least 30 days in advance of making its final earnings crediting decision. The board is scheduled to make that decision on April 3rd of 2017. Statute gives the PERS board broad authority to make earnings crediting decisions across employer and employee accounts. And one thing I would call to the subcommittee's attention is in the back of the LFO analysis is an addendum which summarizes PERS account earnings history from 1997 through 2016. And at the co-chair's pleasure, the agency is here with a brief PowerPoint presentation on their 2016 earnings crediting report, after which will be followed by the LFO recommendation, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. So this is the part where we're looking at an additional presentation from Ms.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee. For the record, Steve Brodman, Executive Director, Public Employees Retirement System. So John gave you a good overview of the reason why we're here. Statute directs that we make a report every year on the preliminary earnings crediting, which we adopted at our January 2017 board meeting. And in line with that 30-day lag, then we're convening again April 3rd to adopt our final earnings crediting. In that report, we highlighted a contingency reserve allocation question which has arisen in this year. So let me give you a little bit of background on the contingency reserve and what the question is that the PERS board is addressing. The contingency reserve is provided in statute, RS 670, and it allows the PERS board to allocate earnings to in excess of the assumed rate, which is currently 7.5%. In any given year to the contingency reserve. So what happens is every time there are earnings over the assumed rate, the PERS board has the discretion to set some of those earnings aside to fund this contingency reserve. Funds in the reserve can only be used for specified purposes, but one of those purposes is a catch-all that allows the PERS board broad discretion in use of this, allocating those funds. So I've given you a table which shows some of the history of these allocations, but let me just maybe take a step back and give you a little more history about this reserve. One point of context to realize about this reserve is we're the only system that I know of in this country that has one. So this is not a normal structure for retirement systems. It is a statute that has allowed for this contingency reserve to exist, and that statute's been there forever, but it's not something that other systems have adopted or have used. In the long ago past, meaning back in the 70s, there was history of some allocations and contributions to this reserve. Back in that time, around the 80s or so, the use of this reserve is really hard to identify because it's basically for contingencies. So you don't know why you need to set this money aside. And if you don't know why, then you certainly have a hard time understanding how much you should set aside. So through the course of the 80s and 90s, there was no money put in the contingency reserve. We fast forwarding now to the 1990s and the high earnings years that we had, there were multiple opportunities for the board to have set money aside into this contingency reserve through those years where we had earnings in excess of the assumed rate. But they chose not to. The employers filed a lawsuit in the late 90s challenging the PERS board's rate orders in 97 and for 1999. That was called the City of Eugene litigation, and the Marion County Judge Lipscomb was the one who wrote the opinion resolving that lawsuit. And in Judge Lipscomb's opinion, he found one of the things that the PERS board had done is abuse its discretion by not funding the contingency reserve when they had the opportunity to do so. So the new PERS board came in 2003, and again, remember, the 2003 legislature dismissed all the members of the current board and brought five new members in. Those five new members came in the context of Judge Lipscomb's opinion saying that the prior board had abused its discretion by not making use of this fund when they could. So through the first couple of years of that board's existence, they put all of the money that they were allowed to into the contingency reserve, because the years of 2003 and 2004 and 2005 were high earnings years. So they built up a reserve of $2 billion. And I'm sorry to belabor this, but it's important to understand kind of the mindset and how it evolves as we go along. The point is, for this first allocation, it looks like a large allocation came out of the reserve in 2004. And it was $1.6 billion. And that's because the PERS board set a funding level of the contingency reserve for $250 million. So a new board comes in, they're learning the system, they're learning the dynamics, learning their responsibilities. In making those decisions, they set aside as much money as they can. That's also the period of time that we had this 2003 legislation being challenged in the courts, not knowing how that was going to be resolved and where the money was going to come to pay for some of those things. Built up a huge reserve. By 2005, in making the decision to allocate 2004 earnings, they realized the court has reached its decision. The bill that we know we have to pay is a fixed amount. We're going to drop the contingency reserve to $250 million. So the funds came out of the contingency reserve. Now let's talk about what goes in and what comes out. I'll skip ahead just a little bit because I think it's easier to see visually with this pie chart. So what this pie chart shows you are all of the various funds and accounts and reserves in PERS that get crediting. And the focus of the contingency reserve discussion is on the orange slice to the lower left, that's employer reserves, the purple slice to the right, that's benefits and forced reserve, and the little thin blue slice between them, which is tier two member regular accounts. The other accounts all get whatever, by statute or rule, they all get credited with whatever earnings are available to them. Tier one gets a guaranteed return. The tier one rate guarantee reserve plays off of that. My point is that their earnings are not used to fund the contingency reserve. When I say earnings in excess of the assumed rate, it's only when earnings in these accounts are in excess of the assumed rate. And when that happens, we take a slice off the top of those earnings, credit less of earnings to those accounts, and use that money to fund the contingency reserve. So that $1.6 billion that was allocated in 2004 went back to the accounts from which the earnings had been withheld previously. So it wasn't new money. It was just money that was held in reserve until the PERS board decided we only need to have $250 million in that reserve, and we're putting those earnings back from whence they came. So this is not a reallocation of winners and losers. This is just crediting back earnings that were previously withheld. The other minor uses over time have been to resolve issues that come up through the administration of the system, such as in 2006 to 2008, one of the changes in the legislation in 2003 needed clarification as far as lump sum vacation payouts and how those triggered or didn't credit contributions and earnings for the IEP. The legislation fixed that came in 2005. We had some member accounts and employer contributions and earnings thereon that we needed to fix, so we took $5 million out of the contingency reserve over time to fix that. In 2011, we took money out of the contingency reserve because 2011 was an opportunity for us to withdraw that money and liquidate what's called the Tier 1 weight guarantee deficit. Like I say, in Tier 1's account, Tier 1 gets the assumed rate. Anything over the assumed rate gets put in this rate guarantee reserve for years when the assumed rate is less than, when earnings are less than the assumed rate. In the 2003 legislation, what you directed was that that rate guarantee reserve can only be held in deficit for 5 years. So after the 2008 market correction, we ran a deficit in that Tier 1 rate guarantee reserve, and it had persisted for a number of years, waiting for excess earnings to catch up. We took the opportunity in 2011 to liquidate that rate guarantee was a deficit from 2008, so we started with a clean slate, because while the law says you can't run a deficit for more than 5 years, the law does not say anything about how to resolve that deficit. So to avoid the question, we thought, let's use a contingency reserve to wipe it out before it persists beyond the deadline, and we have to go back to either you and the legislature or figure out with our employers where that money ought to come from. So in 2014, again, another small allocation was to fix a final average salary question. In 2016, when the Morrow decision concluded that members were entitled to have their COLA restored, from the reductions that you had passed in 2013, we took the money out of the contingency reserve to pay that restored COLA, some $67 million that was returned back to members who were entitled to have their COLA restored. So the struggle I talked about earlier, which has always been there with the contingency reserve, is why do you have it, and what are you going to use it for? And if you don't know what you're going to use it for, then how do you know how much you're supposed to have? So it's an important question to resolve, because when money is in the contingency reserve, and also the rate guarantee reserve, but when money is in the contingency reserve, it is held by the actuaries off book. By that I mean the actuaries look at the assets available to pay the liabilities in the system. The contingency reserve, they don't know that that asset is going to be used to pay benefits, so they hold it off to the side. So every dollar we hold in the contingency reserve is not a dollar that the actuaries consider available to pay benefits. So holding the contingency reserve, money in the contingency reserve, has the effect of increasing employer contributions. So it's not a large contributor to that, but it is that dynamic, which leads us to consider what's the proper level to have in the contingency reserve. Last March, about a year ago, the PERS board addressed that question, and at its March 28, 2016 meeting, the PERS board set a funding target of the contingency reserve of 0.25% of the system's accrued liability. So that funding target was meant that the contingency reserve was overfunded by some $345 million. We have about $583 million in the reserve. $25 million is set aside for employer insolvencies. $21.8 was held aside to resolve the opposite contribution start date issue as requested by our employer advisory group. And then we paid all the material costs of the Morrow project. So there's a balance of about $536 million available. Given that funding level, we've got $345 million in over allocation to the contingency reserve. So the question to the PERS board, meaning this is something that they can choose to do with their upcoming April 3rd meeting, is what to do with that $345 million. is in the past what they've done when they've determined that the contingency reserve is overfunded. They've redistributed that excess funding proportionally to the accounts and reserves whose earnings were used to generate the contingency reserve. So that's, again, as I talked about earlier, jumped ahead a little bit, that's putting more money into those slices of the pie for employer reserves, benefits, and Tier 2. They could also choose to credit those excess, the excess amount from $345 million or so to an existing reserve like the Benefits in Force Reserve or eliminating the deficit in the Tier 1 Rate Guarantee Reserve. They could just leave the money in the contingency reserve and let future draws on the reserve and future growth of the system liabilities catch up to its current funding. But again, as long as that money is held off book, it will not be counted as an asset of the system. Or lastly, given their broad statutory discretion, they can apply the funds to some other purpose that is suggested. So to broaden our thinking about that, we solicited stakeholder input to see what they consider to be the proper use of that over-allocated fund. To date, since we're still within the deadline, I'll just note, we got a comment, if you will, from Greg Hartman, who's the attorney on behalf of the PERS Coalition, which we refer to the PERS Coalition. Those are the unions that represent folks that have membership in PERS. Mr. Hartman's comment was to allocate the funding proportionally to the earnings from to the accounts from which it came, which again is something we've done in the past. I also received earlier this week a letter from your Senate co-chairs of the Workforce Committee, who have asked that we allocate the contingency reserve to reduce the system's unfunded actuarial liability. And to just quote, it's their strong recommendation that the board allocate the excess contingency reserve funds to other reserve accounts where the funds will be credited toward the unfunded liability. So let me explain how that will work. This is just a table with the numbers, but it's maybe, again, easier to see if we go to the picture of the pie chart. So this is the size of the pie. This is the allocation of the PERS fund among all these different accounts and reserves. If you took the $350 million from the contingency reserve, you can see that's the little slice right at the top, the 0.84%. You'd be taking $350 million out of that little slice of the pie, and you'd be spreading it among the employer reserves, the benefits and force reserves, and the Tier 2 member account. All of that would bring it back on the books. All of that would reduce the unfunded actuarial liability, because then it becomes an asset of the system that the actuary can consider when trying to assess the contribution rate.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
But aren't those two things saying exactly the same thing? Or maybe I misunderstood you the first time I saw this presentation, that Mr. Hartman's recommendation was to spread it across the funds, and the workforce co-chairs are saying spread it across the funds, that has the functional effect of diminishing the unfunded liability.
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, both accomplished the same thing. And that's one point I want to make sure I clarify. By bringing the money out of the contingency reserve and putting it into any of the slices here of the pie, you bring it on the books, you reduce the unfunded liability. The question, at least one of two questions, is do you do that proportionally, or do you just put all of it in one slice? Let's say you put it all in the benefits and force reserve. As you all may remember, I've talked about how underfunded that reserve is relative to the liabilities for retired members. So do you put it all in one place, or do you spread it across? Either way, you bring it out of the contingency reserve and you put it on the books to reduce the unfunded liability.
The one follow-up. The one other thing that I wanted to share was I sat through this presentation previously this session, and all of the committee had a fairly quizzical look about this. Mr. Rudman has gone to great pains to explain this in significant detail. The takeaway that I got from the first meeting is this is not crediting money to individual accounts. You're not making any specific PERS beneficiary enriched by taking money out of the contingency fund. You're simply spreading it across these other reserves and thereby having the net effect of reducing liability.
Thank you, Senator Johnson, Co-Chair Manning. If you go back to this slide, which actually has the numbers, you see off to the right what the preliminary crediting rates are. The three lines in the middle, the benefits in force, Tier 2, and employer reserves, currently, those rates are going to be 7.12% on a preliminary basis. Everything else being the same, those might change a few hundred basis points one way or the other, just because we have refined our accounting since the preliminary crediting. But anyway, we're in the neighborhood of 7.12. If you took that $583 million you see at the top line of contingency reserve and took $350 million out of there, and then put that $350 million into the numbers for the 2016 crediting for those three lines, the rate would go up because you would be crediting more earnings to those three accounts. So those three accounts, the rate would increase. If all of that went to spread across the three accounts, those accounts would probably get more than the assumed rate in 2016, because it would have that much of an effect of increasing the number of basis points. If you put it only in the benefits of force reserve, that reserve's return would go up, but the others would stay about where they are at. Either way, again, the unfunded liability is reduced by the amount we bring back onto the books.
Senator? Mr. Co-Chair, thank you. So if you exceed the guaranteed amount, so to speak, we'd want to make sure that it goes into the deficit. Do you have a recommendation of which one of the two choices you would do?
Co-Chair Manning, Senator DeBoer, both of them have that effect. So both of them, like I say, would achieve what the co-chairs of the Workforce Committee have recommended that we do. I don't have a particular recommendation because my board hasn't told me what they want to do yet. Either one accomplishes the UAL reduction that they would like us to do. Arguments for and against. There is some equity in the sense of restoring earnings to Tier 2 member regular accounts, since those accounts earnings were reduced to fund the contingency reserve, so you're just putting it back where it came from. And if I may, you see that's a very small slice of the pie. That's just the blue in the lower right there. So it's not as if we're dramatically increasing the size of those individual accounts. Also, those individual accounts are used to fund their benefits, so to the extent that those accounts are large, that's less money the employers ultimately have to pay to fund those Tier 2 member benefits. So anyway, that may be more equitable, but on the other hand, we know we have a huge deficit in the benefits of force reserve. There's a good argument to say let's put all the money we can in there and try to restore that balance.
So follow up. And I would certainly want to put it in the benefits in force reserve, because we have that huge liability. At some point, I mean, we need to honor our commitments to the PERS recipients, but at some point, we're going to have to come to terms of how we're going to fund it. And we have to take care of that deficit, you know, probably quicker than later. Sir. And then hope that returns go up. I question that the $350 million would increase the yield when it's not actually a yield from investment. It's more or less money we set aside that's now coming back. So I question that you would increase the yield, that would be the proper way to do it, because the yield should be investment income on the reserves.
Co-Chair Manning, Senator DeBoer, understand that the dynamic has been in prior years when we had earnings in excess of the assumed rate, the yield was depressed because we took money away. So you're increasing it this year because you decreased it that year. Again, I'm not making a value judgment. It's just that overall, it kind of all is money in the system. And again, just to be clear, because I know this gets confusing, if we ended up exceeding the assumed rate in the sense of crediting into these accounts, it's not that triggers any extra benefit to anybody. And it will be rolled into the conversation about employer rates for 19, because we make the 19 rates based on the 2016 and 2017 earnings. So it just puts more money into the pot to be available to pay for benefits.
Follow up. So some kind of a footnote, so people looking at this 5-10 years from now, that that the 1 year was that the rate was lower, the next year it was, or the next time it was higher, and it had nothing to do with yield from investments.
Co-Chair Manning, Senator DeBoer, that's good counsel. Thank you. We've done that in the past when there's been some kind of an anomaly in our earnings, and that's good counsel.
Go ahead.
Well, that's pretty much how we got to where we are today. And there's the LFO recommendation, I know, that John was going to cover. So I don't know if you want to move to that.
Are there any other questions from the committee?
Are we looking for a recommendation from this group at which way we want to do
the
it?
The LFO, he's going to provide us with a recommendation.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? No other questions? Thank you, sir.
Okay.
LFO?
Co-chairs and members of the subcommittee, I just want to make sure that we get something on the record here. You know, the discussion this afternoon has been about the crediting of the reserve account, and actually the important piece of the other important piece of the report that is the key piece of the report that the committee historically has heard is the actual earnings crediting overall. So I'll just read a couple sentences from the analysis, and that is that the allocation of 2016 earnings will increase reserve crediting from $64.8 billion to $69.4 billion for a 7.1% increase. That's a in other words, there is $4.6 billion of earnings coming into the system and being allocated. So that's a key piece of it. The LFO recommendation, you know, LFO has the legislature has been receiving this type of report again annually for quite a while. Since 2012, LFO has been noting its concern about this, the use of this contingency fund and its potential deployment. So while LFO believes that the PERS board's decision to consider allocating the funds is prudent, the board has yet to make a final determination on that allocation. And we feel that it's important that prior to them making that decision, that needs to be reported to the legislature. Because again, the board has broad authority to either direct specific allocations or proportional allocations to which accounts. In the perfect world, that would have been and should have been included in this report. It was not. So what LFO is recommending is the following: that you acknowledge receipt of the report with direction that prior to any allocation of contingency fund reserves under ORS 238-670, that the PERS board report to the Joint Ways Joint Committee on Ways and Means on the board's specific recommendations to which accounts the reserve should be deployed and the associated rationale. And that's the LFO recommendation, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee.
If you were ready to take a motion.
I'm ready to take a motion. I was going to defer to.
Oh, fine.
Just one question before. Could we be specific enough to ask for it to be in the benefits of the in-force reserve, or is that improper?
Well, we can. Why don't we go ahead and make the motion, then we'll go into a discussion.
Okay. Mr. Kocher, I think that in LFO's opinion, that would the committee should the subcommittee should wait and hear the specific recommendations of the PERS board. By statute, they've been granted that authority, and if the LFO recommendation is adopted, then the board would come back with its specific recommendations, and at that point you would have more time for deliberate consideration on exactly what they're proposing.
Just one follow-up. I really have to congratulate the investment people that got a 7.1% return last year. It's pretty amazing.
Okay. Representative Comber?
Well, I wish I got that kind of return too. But that being said, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the LFO recommendation.
It has been recommended to move forward the LFO recommendation. Discussion to the motion. Is there any discussion to the motion? Okay, if there is no discussion to the motion, we can do this either one way. We can all do head nods to say agreed, or we can do a voice vote. Are we all in agreement or head nods?
Yeah.
Okay, by unanimous head nod, we have agreed to move this forward to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. And We will close out the work session at this time.
'You won't be here, Senator.
I will be the carrier of the bill. Okay. Anything else? Any unfinished business that we have? Anything else? No unfinished business? We're done? All right. At this time, we will go ahead and do away, end this meeting today, and we will reconvene on Monday.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Before we
Question before we is this the last of our PERS presentation then today? If I would just like to make a comment that I have, this has really been an interesting week. You provided us with great information, well articulated. It's my second time through some of this material, and I understand it better now. And I just want to say thank you because I thought it was really a productive week. Thank you.
Any other comments from committee? If not, we will adjourn today and reconvene on Monday, 1500, 3 o'clock for civilians. We are adjourned. For civilians, we are adjourned.